My guest today, Rich Farrer, who at the end of the year published an extraordinary book, actually self-published an extraordinary book, titled Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict. It is his story, that of an ordinary Jewish American and strongly identified as such, who had been indoctrinated from childhood with all the myths that most Americans, non-Jews as well as Jews, have heard too often repeated and come to believe surrounding the birth of Israel, and how he came to be liberated from those myths and view the Israel-Palestine conflict from a new and vastly different perspective. Welcome, Rich, to Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
There are a number of good books that have been published in recent years about the Israel-Palestine conflict, but most of them approach the subject from an academic standpoint. Yours, although it does describe the litany of injustices visited upon the Palestinian people by Israel, comes at the issue and to the reader from a totally different door, as someone who is in the dark and didn't know it, and who has suddenly emerged into the light. It's a great story, Rich, so please fill our listeners in on it.
Well, basically what happened was, as you said, Jeff, I was very indoctrinated into Zionist ideology, although I never even thought of myself as a Zionist. I was just brought up in the United States, an American Jew in New Jersey, going to Reform Synagogue and Sunday school. But I bought all the myths. I bought all the stories. I believed, especially that having, after following the Holocaust, that it was absolutely imperative that Israel, or that the Jewish people establish their own state. And since the Holy Land was the land of the Torah and the land given to the Jewish people by God, it seemed only natural that that was where the Jewish people belonged. And I never really studied, you know, most Jewish people I know, the very vast majority of Jewish people I know have never studied the issue. They've just believed what they've been taught. And then there's a certain kind of collective logic that people have that simply reinforces these beliefs. But then there's certain events that occur that you read about in the newspapers. And the events that you read about in newspapers generally, at least in our culture, are events that are basically that are critical of Palestinians or Arabs and Muslims, that basically give the impression that the Palestinian people and many of the Arab people are brought up in a culture of hatred towards Jews or a culture of hatred towards the West, towards democracy. And, of course, this is all very false. And I remember, as a slight aside, I read an article in the Los Angeles Times a few years ago in which they actually stated that for every one Israeli death at the hands of a Palestinian, it is reported in American newspapers in two articles. But it takes 15 Palestinian deaths at the hands of Israelis before it will be reported in one article. So there's a huge disparity in the reporting. It's basically very biased in favor of Israel. So I believed all this stuff, and then a couple things happened that really reinforced my beliefs. The first was in 2000 at the end of the Camp David summit. And what happened was I was watching the McNeil Lehrer report, and Dennis Ross, who was the chief U.S. Middle East negotiator at that summit, was being interviewed. And he basically stated that he made it very clear that Israel had offered the Palestinians an extraordinarily generous peace offer, that all of the Palestinians, including Yasser Arafat, at first had accepted it. And then the next day, Yasser Arafat started expressing reservations about his acceptance, and that he really didn't want to accept it, and that even though his fellow Palestinian negotiators were begging him to accept, to stay, you know, to stay on course and accept the agreement, he refused to, and that he sabotaged the summit. So I believe that, and that really reinforced my belief that Israel had always wanted peace and had bent over backwards to make peace with the Palestinians, but the Palestinians really never really wanted peace. That was the first thing. In 2006, as we know, the Second Lebanon War began allegedly after Hezbollah crossed over into northern Israel and I think captured two Israeli soldiers and killed three. And then Israel retaliated. And that was about a 3 to 4 week onslaught against the country of Lebanon. Now, when that started, that further confirmed to me that the Arab world, there was just no way that there would ever be peace, that the Arab world was so intent on killing Jews and destroying Israel that that their irrationality about this would prevent them from even considering peace. And so I started complaining to friends about this, to two of my closest and most wise friends. And I had known that they had always been critical of Israel, but I figured in this situation it was obvious that Israel was in the right, that Israel was the innocent, aggrieved party. And this especially so because 3 weeks earlier, Hamas had captured Gilad Shalit from the Israel-Gaza border. And so it seemed to me that this was an orchestrated attempt on the part of Arab groups to simply delegitimize and eventually destroy Israel. Well, my friends didn't agree with me. And their disagreement with me, their arguing with me, merely reinforced my resistance to their point of view. But then, serendipitously, my friend Sam, who I'd known since we were in nursery school together, happened to call me to tell me that he was going to be flying out west to attend a bar mitzvah in Colorado, and that he was going to come down after it to spend a week with me in New Mexico. And Sam is someone who has always studied the issue on his own. He's rather laid back about it, he's not very vocal about it, but he's always studied the Israel-Palestine issue. And I started complaining to him about the actions of Hezbollah and the entire Arab world and Hamas and all the Palestinians and how hateful they were. And he just listened to me. He didn't argue with me at all. And every once in a while he would stop me and say, no, you're wrong about that. This is the situation. But he let me go on and on. And then at the end of the two-hour conversation, he suggested I read books by a couple Israeli scholars and that I also check out a good website that had many articles by many other scholars on the subject. And so I decided to do that. And then what happened was I ended up, he gave me the space to consider the possibility that at the very least I didn't really know as much as I thought I did. And I realized, I really should look into this more. And really in the back of my mind I figured, okay, I'll look into it and I'll just reconfirm my views. But I made a decision to only look at books by Jewish and Israeli Jewish scholars. So I went to the library, got some books out, and then I started reading. And during the course of my reading, really in the first few days of reading, I started seeing just how egregious Israel's actions had been for many years against the Palestinian people. And the first book I was reading was Beyond Chutzpah by Norman Finkelstein. At the time, I didn't know just how controversial Finkelstein was. But I knew immediately when I started reading the book that whether I agreed with what he was saying or not, the guy was a brilliant, brilliant scholar. And not only that, his documentation was meticulous, and he was documenting with mainstream sources such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and many other well-known sources. And I occasionally, as I was reading, I would occasionally go online, if that was possible, and check to see if Finkelstein was quoting verbatim, like he should have been, and if he was quoting in context. And in every single case I checked, he was doing everything above board. His integrity was unimpeachable. And so at a certain point, after reading all these human rights abuses, the use of lethal force in situations where there was no threat to Israeli soldiers, collective punishment, collective destruction of homes, the theft of land, all kinds of things, I went through a series of rather dramatic emotions. At first, I was just shocked at what I was reading. But then that shock became anger at Israel for treating people in such a way and for doing it in the name of the Jewish people. And then that anger, I realized that I had no one to be angry at except for myself, because I'm the one who had chosen to remain ignorant and simply assume that what I'd learned as a child was true without even really examining it. And then that anger towards myself turned into shame and then embarrassment. And then I felt this deep sorrow for the suffering of the Palestinian people, for the suffering of millions of people who I had been completely deaf to. And at that point, I put the book down. And when I put the book down, I kind of just closed my eyes and I went into this space. And I don't know how to describe the space, although I try in the epilogue to my book. And I don't know how long I was in this space of nothingness, but when I opened my eyes, I noticed that I didn't have any of these emotions that I had just gone through. I felt cleansed. And not only did I feel cleansed, I felt free. And then a whole series of things happened. I noticed I could not find a Jewish identity. I tried to reanimate that Jewish identity, and I could not. I tried to reanimate my fear and terror at some of the horrible things that Al-Qaeda had done and other terrorist organizations, such as beheading people, including that the guy in Iraq, Berg, I think his name was Berg. That was very horrifying. The young man who...
Danny Pearl, you mean?
No, in Iraq.
Oh, Berg, yes.
He's the guy,
that's right. Yeah.
That was a horrifying thing, and as I recall, they even showed it on the internet. It was available to watch the beheading itself on the internet. Anyway, all of these events had stimulated a great deal of fear in me and a great deal of judgment towards the society that I was judging as being guilty of these horrible events. But I could not reanimate my fear. And what arose within me instead of fear was equanimity and the understanding, the realization, that no matter how horrible the actions of some of these extremists, who I realized were a small minority of the Arab world, no matter how horrible their actions, they really had the same goal in their heart as I did, which was peace, peace within themselves and peace within the world. Their strategy to achieve that peace was, you could say, insane, certainly inhumane. But strategy aside, we all had the same goals, which was to live in freedom with self-determination. And so this propelled me to continue studying, and I mostly studied the works of Israeli Jewish scholars. I spent a lot of time on Israeli government websites and institutions. And I can say that you don't need to go outside of Israeli sources to show that what Israel has always done, what Israel has always wanted to do, is to ethnically cleanse the land of the Palestinians and claim virtually all of it, all of the Holy Land, including the West Bank, for themselves.
Well, you certainly, I was very impressed. I grew up in a different kind of household, although, a Jewish household, but did not have to fight my parents or my beliefs, because my early experiences with Israel through my parents were not positive. And in the early years of Israel, a number of Israeli Jews would come and visit my parents' home in Los Angeles and say they had left Israel. This was in the 50s, when there was no PLO, that they couldn't live in a country that was so racist, because every time Palestinians who had been expelled from their land would launch an attack on a settlement or a kibbutz or something like that, there'd be virtually a pogrom, is how they described it, among the Arab Palestinians who had remained after what they call the Nakba in 1948.
Right.
And when I went to Europe, I ran into other Israelis who had left Israel for the same reason. It was years before I met an Israeli who had anything good to say about the country. So I've run into your attitude, the attitude that you had when I came back from my first trip to the Middle East in 1970. People who were progressive in every other issue, when it came to this particular issue, they closed up like a shell, and they had the same opinions that they would not challenge, but you're challenging them is really unique. I know people have gone through this but some years ago, but to do it so recently and then not only change your opinion but then act on it. You went over to Palestine, you saw what was happening, and you've done research on it. It's quite remarkable.
Well, thank you. What I want to say, though, what's interesting is your story, that never occurred. I never met anyone growing up who had any Jewish person who had anything negative to say about Israel. But one of the things that's interesting is I grew up in a Reform Jewish family, my immediate family. Now, my father's brothers, my father had four brothers, one of whom was basically a civil rights attorney. They, at least three of them, were basically atheist. And there was very little discussion ever about Israel. Occasionally, you might hear that something like, well, the most likely place for a nuclear holocaust to occur is the Middle East because of the Arabs wanting to destroy Israel. You might hear that occasionally, because, again, this was also in the 50s, during the time when both Russia and the United States were testing nuclear weapons. But one of the things that was interesting is in my Reform Synagogue Sunday school, there were two photographs in my classroom, one of David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, and one of Chaim Weizmann, Israel's first president. And I would look at these photographs, and the way I would interpret it, and I'm pretty sure most other kids interpreted it the same way, is that these are the two main leaders of Israel. These are the two men who are protecting or who made the protection of the Jewish people so important that they were able to establish a state so Jewish people would have a safe haven away from all the hatred towards Jews. And so when you get that idea, you can't... As a 6, 7, 8-year-old kid, when you get this idea that David Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann are such wonderful men protecting me and the rest of my people, and therefore Israel is such a wonderful country, you just kind of, through osmosis, start developing this logic. And then you can't believe that, oh, well, Israeli soldiers would never commit atrocities. If Israel soldiers killed anybody, it had to be in self-defense. And you wouldn't be able to believe, for example, that Israel soldiers would rape women in massacres in Palestinian villages, or that they would indiscriminately kill or line people up against the wall and kill them, or, you know, none of that was believable. So when I got older and I occasionally heard things like that, I simply didn't believe it. To me, it was just anti-Semitic propaganda.
Well, they have that concept that they've spread, that Israel military has a concept, a guide called purity of arms, and which is such an atrocious piece of propaganda. What's interesting, I found, was in your own family, you've had to conduct these battles because you have a brother who's not only religious, he's Orthodox and living on a settlement, I believe.
Well, no, my identical twin brother.
Right,
at one time, before, actually in 1970, when he finished college, he went to Israel to live on a kibbutz, and he was not religious at the time. But while he was there, he started taking courses at the local yeshiva, which was a Chabad Lubavitch yeshiva, apparently. And he ended up having some kind of a revelation and decided to become Lubavitcher. And he is extremely ultra-Orthodox. He's very, very doctrinaire and very rigid in his thinking. But he lived in Israel a few years, got married, and then came back to the United States and now lives in Canada. However, two of his two daughters both live in Israel with their husbands and children. And they're also ultra-Orthodox, although none of my brother's kids, he's got 8 kids in all, none of them are as extreme in their views as my brother is. My brother takes his opinions to be fact, and he refuses to investigate those, quote, facts. And in fact, the real facts are irrelevant to him. And this is typical. This is typical of what I experience in the Jewish community, Reform, all the way from atheist Jew to ultra-Orthodox.
Well, this is true. Even those who don't believe in God will use the God as a real estate agent as the last resort.
That's true.
What's interesting is your investigation of the debate between Norman Finkelstein and Alan Dershowitz, which informs a couple of chapters in there. Dershowitz, who known as a civil rights attorney and litigant for people who have in major cases. I mean, right. but here's a man who's actually advocated torture. And maybe you could talk about what you found out about Alan Dershowitz and his conflict with Norman Finkelstein.
Well, what I found out was that a large section of Beyond Chutzpah.
This is a book by Norman Finkelstein.
By Norman Finkelstein. A large section of that book basically totally debunks Alan Dershowitz's book called The Case for Israel. And what's interesting is Beyond Chutzpah is a play on Dershowitz's autobiography, which he wrote years before The Case for Israel. Dershowitz's autobiography is called Chutzpah. So Finkelstein called his book Beyond Chutzpah because he wanted to show how absurd Dershowitz's book was in making the case for Israel. And one of the things he shows, which takes a lot of scholarship to discover this, is that Dershowitz routinely, in fact, in there are 22 paragraphs that Dershowitz lifted from Joan Peters' book From Time Immemorial, but did not credit her as the source. What he did was he would take Joan Peters' paragraphs and then quote her source.
Can you briefly describe to the listeners Joan Peters' book, and right. which was a very important propaganda piece for the right. pro-Israel forces here, but disregarded in Israel.
Right. Joan Peters' book was written in the mid-80s, and it became a bestseller. And basically, its main thesis, I guess you could say, was that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people. The so-called Palestinians were really other Arabs from surrounding Arab nations, including Northern Africa, who had come to the Holy Land to get jobs from kind-hearted Jewish landholders because the kind-hearted Jewish landholders treated them better than the people they worked for in the Arab countries. And it went on to say that, so basically, the people eventually defined themselves as Palestinians, but they were really Libyans, Moroccans, Algerians, Tunisians, Saudi Arabians, etc., from the region. And it basically gave people like me an argument, a really important argument, to say that, well, whatever the so-called Palestinian people are claiming today, it's kind of irrelevant because they're a fraud. They never really existed in the first place. And you know, Golda Meir, years before Joan Peters wrote that book, had said that there was no such thing as a Palestinian people. And, of course, in Israel, they never refer to Palestinians as Palestinians. They refer to them as Arabs. So Joan Peters' book, anyway, eventually Joan Peters' book was thoroughly discredited, not only by scholars like Norman Finkelstein, but by, like, for example, Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, who's now deceased, but he was the vice president of the World Jewish Congress and a scholar, a professor at Dartmouth College, and he said that, that her work was worthless, that she was simply repeating old Zionist myths. And Yehoshua Horoth, a famous scholar of the Middle East, I believe at Hebrew University in Israel, he basically said that the book was worthless, that its only value was as a propaganda tool for the Zionists, and that anyone who knew Zionist mythology knew that all she had done was recycle those myths that had been totally discredited or at least modified. And Avi Shlaim, one of the famous Israeli historians, called the book completely worthless. And even Daniel Pipes and Martin Peretz, two neocon supporters of Israel, live or die, you know. Even they eventually admitted that her scholarship was rather shabby. And yet Dershowitz, who knew all this, used her as a main source without citing her much of the time in his book. But furthermore, he took things out of context. I checked some of the accusations that Finkelstein made against Dershowitz. And for example, just one small example, Dershowitz is quoting Raji Sarani, who's the head of a Gaza health, I believe a Gaza health organization. And Dershowitz...
Well, legal organization.
Oh, okay, it's a legal organization.
Yeah.
Dershowitz quotes Sarani as saying that I'm constantly amazed at the high standards of the Israeli Supreme Court. That's not an exact quote, but that's basically what Dershowitz quotes Sarani saying. But when you read the whole quote, and it's from the New York Times, when you read the whole quote is, I'm constantly amazed at the high standards of the Israeli Supreme Court when it comes to issues like gay people and other things within Israel. But when it comes to the Palestinian people, they're completely schizophrenic. So Dershowitz leaves out the last part of the sentence and makes it look like Raji Sarani is supporting or is praising Israel for its high standards of justice towards everybody, when in fact he's showing that their standards of justice are schizophrenic because they're only fair towards Israeli Jews. And then there's many other things that Dershowitz does that are absurd, like quoting a ninth grader from a junior high school newspaper as one of his sources, and also even distorting the view of Benny Morris, the famous Israeli historian, who himself is a staunch Zionist. Dershowitz takes his work out of context, quotes him when it feels appropriate to do so for Dershowitz's purposes, and then ignores him and uses himself as a source without citing anybody else to make claims that are completely untrue and can easily be disproven. So it was just a travesty what Dershowitz did.
And Dershowitz went on to try and prevent the book from being published, and then actually was almost single-handedly responsible for Finkelstein not getting being fired from DePaul University.
Right, and in the end, I think it all backfired on Dershowitz because it showed many people just how vicious Dershowitz could be, how unfair he could be, and it gave much greater attention to Norman Finkelstein and his work. And I'm sure many, many more people have read Finkelstein's books now as a result of Dershowitz's actions.
And they even made a movie about it. Dershowitz is kind of backfired. My guest is Rich Foer. We're talking about his book, Breakthrough: Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict. We're going to open the phones here for your calls. For number here, 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. We do have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
Interesting, and I really appreciate your candor. A point and then a question for you, Rich. I guess the release of the Palestine Papers really puts the lie to a couple of phrases that are always used in the American media and by the Israelis. One is, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. We read that all the time. And then the second mantra, of course, is from the Israelis, and they say, there's nobody to talk to. There's nobody to negotiate with. They're too intransigent. Those have become mantras in our dialogue over here. But my question for you is, could you give us your perspective on how it is that the Israel lobby has such a firm death grip on the Congress of the United States? That's my question. Thanks so much.
Well, I mean,
it's a good question, caller.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, first of all, our culture has always been rather biased against, I know people are going to get angry for saying this, but against people of color. Now, Jews, of course, were heavily discriminated against up through the 50s and into the 60s, and I don't think there's too much discrimination in this country towards Jewish people anymore. But because of all of this, and because of the fact that Jewish people, more so than the more so percentage-wise in the population, became very well educated, it became clear to some Jewish people that they should form a lobbying organization to protect their interests, which they saw as also the interest of Israel. And there's never been a really strong Palestinian lobbying organization in the United States. And, I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. I don't think there's a conspiracy, but there are so many Jewish people in government, in finance, that they're able to exert a huge influence on the administration as well, and in particular, Congress. And, that's all I can say. I mean, I think that that combined with the fact that they send out letters to Jewish people and probably other people too throughout the country, warning them about Israel's existential threat. And they make it sound like, as a Jew, you really need to support your country because your country is the land of the Jewish people and it's always under attack. And because people have all these images of the past, of pogroms throughout Eastern Europe for hundreds of years, culminating, of course, in the Holocaust, because people have all these images, they believe what AIPAC, for example, the main Jewish lobbying organization, tells them. And of course, because the media is rather conflicted and biased, in my opinion, towards Israel, at least it has been until maybe recently, and then people simply, out of fear, they join these organizations, they support these organizations, and more importantly, they believe these organizations. And I remember when I was a member of AIPAC, I would get a newsletter every 2 weeks, and once I started studying the subject, I saw that much of what they were saying was completely false, and it was just opinion, which they were stating as fact. And so, I mean, that's basically it. What I'm saying is it's very easy for people to be indoctrinated because most people don't seem to be interested in taking the effort, taking the time to study things for themselves. So they look for authority figures or people who portray themselves as knowing something, and they start believing them, especially when they're believing what has already sounded familiar to them in the first place. Does that answer your question?
Very good. I think he probably hung up. We have a full board here. We're going to go to the next question.
Okay.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for this program. It's wonderful. I wanted to sympathize with the guest, Rick Foer. Can you spell that for me?
F as in Frank, O-R-E-R. Richard Foer, F-O-R-E-R.
F-O-R?
R-E-R.
R-E-R, good, because I'm going to get your book.
But, RichardFoer.com.
Okay, very good. Thank you, because I didn't know how to spell it. But anyway, I understand his problem because the United States is propagandized. We don't know anything about our history, actually, except for what we're told in the schools. And if you read Howard Zinn, it's a totally different thing than what you're taught when you go to grammar school and things like that. But I also wanted to ask him, had he read The Gun and the Olive Branch by David Hurst, which started me on my journey to understand Israel and the whole history of what is happening. And he is a Jewish man who writes for the Palestinians.
Yes, I have read David Hurst's book. I think
Very
it's a wonderful
good.
Book. Oh, are you still talking?
Yes.
Yes, and I also, just one more thing. You were talking about Norman Finkelstein. I think it's Finkelstein. They say Steinstein. But I also wanted to know, what has happened to the man since the American Radical DVD, where he was being deposed by certain elements of power? Anyway, thank you. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, actually, the David Hirsch's, that's one of the, David Hirsch's one of the very first books in English on the subject. A very good one.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it's an excellent book. I quote him in my book, among other books. I have a very good bibliography in my book for readers. As far as Norman Finkelstein, you know, I need to contact him. But it seems that he's speaking all over the world. I mean, he seems to be very popular now, which is good. He recently published a book on the Gaza, on Operation, I believe it was on Operation Cast Lead, which of course happened December 2008 into January 2009. I think the book is published by Other Press and is available through Other Press. And he's still doing his work, and I think he's a great credit to Jewish people all over the world, whether they can acknowledge that or not.
One of the things you bring up, and you mentioned using Israeli and Jewish sources, which I have actually used a lot of my writings, but there was also, you mentioned in your book, that there has been a reticence, which I've noticed even among anti-Zionist Jews, progressive Jews, that when a non-Jew criticizes Israel, they become suspect, as if we've been so indoctrinated to see anti-Semitism around under the bed and around the corner, and that every I wasn't brought up that way, fortunately, but many of my friends were, that the Gentiles are born imbibing, as Itzhak Shamir said, into anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. Right. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, what I would basically say is that you have to develop some discrimination. I mean, you described it very well. What happens is, when someone feels threatened, when let's say, using this example, when a Jewish person hears something that's critical of their religion, or that's critical in particular of Israel, most people, at least when you talk to people who defend Israel, they will not look into their feelings. What happens is, I mean, this all happens kind of unconsciously or subconsciously and very quickly, but if I say something like, well, you know, David Ben-Gurion acknowledged that Israel had stolen the land from the Palestinians, a Jewish person who defends Israel will automatically react in a way where they contract, and various emotions will arise, starting with fear and with real fear, because the fear is that their identity is being threatened, because most of us are, like I was, I'll use myself as an example, my beliefs about Israel and the Jewish people were part of my identity. I had fused them with my identity. And so when someone would say something critical of Israel, I would react with fear, and then I would turn that fear into anger, and I would accuse the other person of not knowing what he was talking about. Fortunately, in my case, I never called someone an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew, but I've heard it a lot. And what's really happening is it's scapegoating. When someone calls me or you, Jeff, or anybody who's simply stating a fact, when they call them an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew, it's a reflection of their inability or refusal to look at what is arising within them and to examine their beliefs. It's much easier to simply scapegoat the source of your threat as anti-Semitic or self-hating, because that lets you off the hook. If they're anti-Semitic or self-hating, well, then they're irrational, and what they're saying is simply propaganda.
Exactly. Let's go to the next call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Seems like we're on to the perennial topic of the Jewish lobby again this morning. What the gentleman said I summarized as he was looking at the Jewish people as a collection of individuals, and he didn't use the word, but basically that they were propagandized. And we know that we have other commentators have talked about the manufacturer of consent.
Try to make this quick, because we're coming down the end of the wire.
Okay, well, the question is, what are the other, aside from individual Jewish people, what are the forces, economic and political, that also have to be lined up to really, for instance, to make the propaganda system work effectively? What other interests are there that supporting Israel?
Got it. Thanks very much. Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, well, it's all a reflection of our belief system. And every culture, I mean, I'm not saying that Jewish people are more indoctrinated than other people. It's just that in this day and age, this is an issue that is really gaining a lot, that really has a lot of traction, that has a huge impact on the world because of Islamic extremism, and also because of the refusal of many people to give Palestinians the rights that Israelis enjoy. But, I mean, it's all part of a collective belief system where the political expression is an expression of that indoctrination, so the media is involved. I mean, when I read the New York Times, people like Thomas Friedman, who's a very well-known journalist, I mean, I can see how conflicted he is. He really wants to Israel to make peace. He recognizes that there are certain imbalances and certain behaviors of Israel that are unfair, but it's very hard for him to give up his Jewish identity, and because of that, he's unable to really go all the way. He's unable to really acknowledge that what is really happening.
Rich, at this point, we've come down to the end of the hour. I want people to be able to get a hold of your book. You say it's available on your website at richforer.com. It's also available on Amazon. It's self-published. I assume that if some of our local booksellers wish to get copies of it, they can order it through your website. That's correct?
Yes, that is correct. Or they can contact me. They can contact me through the website, because obviously they're going to want to get a wholesale price.
Right.
Yes,
can I give your email out?
Yes, you may.
It's rich, and then richforer at gmail.com. Rich, this has been a very enlightening interview. I'm really glad I was able to have you on the air, and I'm really glad you've written this book, because I think it is a breakthrough book.
Thank you very much.
And as you see, our listeners also enjoy hearing you. So anyway, thanks very much, and I look forward to seeing what your next book will be.
That would be great.
And thanks for joining the struggle. Take care.
Thank you, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.